listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, there's a lot of interesting stuff in the news today that I think is worth discussing. Of course, this new ad out basically accusing Republican budget cuts of leaving the United States vulnerable to Ebola. I think it's interesting. It's fairly solid. There's another interesting story, and this is at the risk of being a little too inside baseball, but it has to do with the media. And if you're listening or watching, you're consuming media. There's a story over at, actually there's a couple of them. Daily Banner has a good piece on this, but the original story is over at Mediaite, Joe Concha, saying that he's got a source inside MSNBC who's saying that Ronan Farrow, the daughter of Mia Farrow and theoretically Woody Allen, although I understand Woody Mia Farrow has said that she had a relationship with Frank Sinatra and a lot of, you know, Ronan Farrow kind of looks like him, and who knows? It added when he was first announced, he had never done a talk show even on cable news, and apparently Phil Griffin, the head of MSNBC, thought, hey, big name. How about that? Might even be Sinatra's son. Who knows? You know, and so there's a curiosity factor. There's a big name factor. The guy's really smart. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He's got a great CV. He's got a famous family. Let's put him on the air. I've seen this movie before. I was on Air America and decided, you know, Air America's not doing so well. I had lost confidence in management, shall we say, and decided to leave Air America about 6 months before the network went down. Maybe it was a little longer than that. And so they went out and they hired Montel Williams for $1 million a year, which was massively more than they'd been paying me. And just as no bitterness here or anything like that, but just, you know, I was astounded. $1 million a year. And his ratings went in the toilet. I think that this idea that, you know, let's get somebody who's got a famous name and throw a bunch of money at him and put him on the air, as opposed to somebody who has demonstrated that they can build an audience, is a dumb way to program. Case in point, Rush Limbaugh. I'm serious about this. Rush Limbaugh started the same year I did in radio. As a teen, we were both, you know, we're the same age. We started as teenagers as DJs back in the 60s, the late 60s. 68, as I recall. And he knew how to do radio. And he had been doing a talk show out in, he'd been doing it in California for a while. He'd been doing it in the Midwest someplace. And in 87, as I recall, you know, they rolled out a national talk show starring Rush Limbaugh. And he's good at what he does. I disagree with what he says. I question his facts and sometimes his motivations for those facts. But he's a very, very good entertainer slash performer slash talk show host. I mean, you know, this is show business. And it wasn't like a bunch of guys sat around and said, hey, let's put Rush Limbaugh on the air. He's nationally famous, and he's got a rich and powerful and famous family. No, nobody ever heard of the guy. But he built a show based on doing a good show. I think, frankly, that's what Louise and I have done with this program over the last 11 years. And I think there's a bunch of others out there that have built good shows and good followings based on talent. And based on having something to say. So there's that issue. And I'm guessing, you know, Ronan Farrow, I've watched the show a couple times. I think that, you know, this is a guy who's got a lot of potential. And I believe has a lot to say. I'm not sure that MSNBC has been the right place for him to say it. But, you know, time will tell. He's got a lot of years ahead of him. But a larger issue is being brought up by this whole thing. And that is, in general, MSNBC's ratings are in the tank. And in fact, the article is speculating about other MSNBC hosts who might be toast. And I just want to say why I think that's happening. And I think it has very little to do, frankly, having just said, you know, giving somebody a national television show who has never done media might not be the smartest thing to do. But that said, it certainly has happened over on Fox News more than once. Although, you know, actually, when they bring the famous names on, they tend to bring them on, you know, here's Karl Rove, here's Dick Morris, whatever. They bring them on as guests. Again, you know, Sean Hannity got famous for filling in for Rush Limbaugh. Bill O'Reilly worked his way up through the business. But this morning, as I was walking down to the metro station to take the train here to work, here to the radio studio, there was a guy standing out in front of the metro, out in front of the subway, passing out the local right-wing newspaper. There's a daily right-wing, about 24, 36-page, small tabloid-sized newspaper published here in Washington, D.C. And it's everywhere. And somebody is paying these guys to pass out your daily dose of right-wing propaganda. And I'm sitting on the subway, and I got on the side, and that particular subway I got on at the waterfront stop, so it had started, you know, down way beyond Navy Yard. It started way over in Maryland or Virginia or someplace. And by the time we got to Chinatown, which is where I changed trains, there must have been six or eight people out of the probably 150 who were in the train car. I mean, it was a busy time of day, right? It was 9 o'clock in the morning. There must have been a dozen people in that train, just in that one car, who were reading that right-wing newspaper. You have Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox, who, you know, and Roger Ailes running Fox, but Murdoch also owns the Wall Street Journal. He owns the New York Post. I believe he now owns, the Chicago Tribune? Did he buy the Tribune papers? Maybe not. Okay, anyhow, he's got, pardon? Sky News, yeah, that's in the UK. He's got, and he's the Times of London and the, you know. So basically he's got this right-wing echo chamber of his own. And then there's this larger right-wing echo chamber, and it's all very well-funded. I personally know a bunch of people who are right-wing talk show hosts. I've traveled around the world with a couple of them, you know, to do reporting, to do gigs. I've been to Africa with them. I've been to Israel with them. And what I've learned is that if you're a right-wing talk show host, even if you're not being paid an enormous amount of money, you can get these incredible speaking fees for doing virtually nothing, $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 for giving a speech. It's not really for giving a speech. It's like the right wing takes care of its own. Nothing like that exists on the left. And so I would submit to you that what has happened is that there's this right-wing echo chamber in the United States. Hillary Clinton referred to it back when her husband was president as the vast right-wing conspiracy. There is this right-wing echo chamber, much of which is very well-funded. There was a piece on Politico a few months ago about how Mark Levin and Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity literally get millions of dollars every year in support from these right-wing foundations and from billionaires. Nothing like that happening on the left again. Nothing. And that echo chamber then creates the demand for more of the information. I would say that that is what's driving Fox's quality in the ratings. I'm curious. Well, hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And I want to take this to the next step, and I'm going to do that after the break, which is what has happened to news in America? Can a society exist when the news is owned by the billionaires? And welcome back. Oh, interesting. Jerry in Santa Fe, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV, you want to disagree with me that Columbus and ISA are roughly the same thing?
No. Columbus and ISIL are totally different things.
Okay.
Columbus was a European settler, imperialist, or colonialist. His beginning started an imperial settler movement in North America that completely dominated the indigenous people.
Right.
ISIL is indigenous people trying to take their world back from the European or Western colonies that have attempted to conquer it since Napoleon in 1800.
Well, arguably, have attempted to conquer it since Pope Innocent or Pope Pius the Third declared the first crusade in 1310 or something like that.
I think it was Urban.
It was the 10-somethings. Yeah. Okay.
Pope Urban, that was in 1090s or so. Regardless. Columbus was a European settler imperialist, and ISIL is indigenous people.
Right.
Just now, the comparison to ISIL is JSIL, which is also European settler, colonial imperialists who are trying to take a piece of Asia for their own, and it is colonial imperialism.
Wait a minute, what's JSIL?
JSIL being the Jewish state in the Levant.
So you're talking about Israel.
Yes, I'm talking about Israel, which is the Jewish state.
Now the Zionists would argue that they're also indigenous people. I realize there's a difference between Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews, but at least for Sephardic Jews, you could build a very, very strong case that they're indigenous people, too.
They would argue that the Sephardic Jews are indigenous. They have a harder time arguing that the European Jews are indigenous.
Right, the Ashkenazi.
Because the European Jews are probably Europeans.
Right.
And but Columbus and ISIL are two different ball games entirely, because one of them is colonialist and one of them is indigenous.
Right. Very interesting.
Okay, I made my point, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, you did, Jerry, and thank you. It's very thought-provoking. We're kind of conditioned, I think, instantly to think of ISIL or ISIS or IS or the Islamic State, whatever, as being these horrible, horrible guys, because they're sending us videotapes of them beheading our people. But if you think of them as locals, and probably most of them are, who are saying, enough already, get the hell out of our property. Wow, let me chew on that for a while. Thank you. Thank you for that call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes. To take this conversation even a step further, how does a nation exist if it doesn't have an informed citizenry? This was a question that Thomas Jefferson asked and really laid out. You know, it was one of the reasons why he started the University of Virginia after he left the White House in 1809 and, you know, spent the next decade or so starting a free college, so that there would be an informed and educated electorate. It was the thing that in 1832 or 36, in the 1830s, when Alexis de Tocqueville came to the United States from France and ended up writing Democracy in America, his kind of travelogue, the thing that he was so amazed about Americans is how well-informed they were, that the average farmer knew about French politics. There was demand for news. Now, you could argue that in times of great change, there's demand for news, and people stepped in to meet that demand. There were a lot of newspapers, and they carried these stories. But the news was not regulated by the government. There was no demand that you actually had to produce news. There were newspapers that were just rags. There were newspapers that were propaganda pieces. There were newspapers, you know, there were pro-slavery and anti-slavery newspapers. There were I was going to say democracy, but it's such a shaky term. But there were basically the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists back then. What ultimately became the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans, today called the Democratic Party. And then it became the Democratic Republicans, and it changed their name to the Democrats, and the Federalists died out, and they became the Whigs. But throughout that period of time, you had newspapers that were clearly in one camp or the other. Sort of like Fox News, clearly in one camp, MSNBC clearly in another. We survived. We figured out what was going on. So, you know, on the one hand, I look at I want to get Jeff Cohen on. I'm hoping he'll be available at the bottom of the hour. He wrote this book, Cable News Confidential, some years ago. He used to work at MSNBC, was on the air on MSNBC, was the executive producer of the Phil Donahue show. In fact, he was here in our studio a couple of weeks ago with Phil Donahue. Actually, it was Norman Solomon who was with Phil Donahue. But in any case, Jeff and Norman were here in town, had dinner with him, in fact, about a month ago. We had in the United States, from the 1930s until 1987, a requirement that news actually be news. It was not enforced much by the government. The industry was all about kind of self-regulation at that point in time. Those of you who are old enough to remember will know what I'm talking about when I lay this out. Those of you who aren't, hopefully you'll be enlightened by this. But from the 20s or the 30s, it was somewhere between 1927 and 1935, the Federal Communications Commission came into being. Originally, there was the Red Network and the Blue Network, and, you know, they ultimately became other things. And then TV came along in the 50s and 60s, and on it went. And the idea was, if you're using our airwaves, the airwaves are part of the commons. They're part of the public property. If you're using the airwaves to do anything, to play polka music, to play Father Coughlin's rants, these were the things that were big back in the 30s, to play country music, to play... fill in the blank. If you're using the public airwaves, the price you pay for that public bandwidth, which is regulated and administered by the government, by we the people, by the commons, and that, by the way, came into place in the 19-teens and 1920s out of necessity, because stations were just stepping all over each other, and somebody had to step in and say, okay, you have that bandwidth, you have this bandwidth, you can't interfere with each other, you know, just make it a friendly place for consumers. The price that you paid was that you had to run news. You had to do what was called programming in the public interest. And there was this doctrine in the FCC called the Fairness Doctrine, which President Obama did away with last year, or this year, and which Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing in 1987. So it really hasn't been around since 87. And the Fairness Doctrine didn't say if you have an hour of liberals, you have to have an hour of conservatives. I know that, you know, Rush Limbaugh would like you to believe that. Didn't say that. What it said was, if you want to have your license renewed every year, you have to prove your programming in the public interest. And the way that stations did this is they picked up news typically from networks. And they ran it at the top of the hour, sometimes the top and the bottom of the hour. The TV stations ran it for an hour to start out prime time every night, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. And the networks lost money on this. But arguably, we were well informed. And having worked in news back in the 1970s, I can tell you, I could have been fired had I been seen talking to salespeople at the radio station I worked at. It was like there was this absolute firewall between revenue and news. That all changed in 87 when Reagan stopped the enforcement of the Fairness Doctrine. But we did fine for 150 years without the Fairness Doctrine. Or did we do fine? I mean, there are those who argue that William Randolph Hearst created the Spanish-American War by saying to Frederick Remington, give me the pictures and I'll give you the war. And Remington sent him the picture of the USS Maine on fire in Havana Harbor, and boom, we get the Spanish-American War.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So the question is really a huge one, and it's how do you have a functioning small-d democracy when the news is not the news? 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, another piece of this, I think, is that MSNBC is a premium channel. You have to pay extra to get it in most places. And Fox has made the decision to be a free channel. I mean, it's basically everywhere. But Jeff Cohen is with us, a professor of journalism, founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, the author of Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media, the co-founder of RootsAction.org, and the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, a former producer of The Donahue Show, former star of MSNBC and Screen and Stage. Jeff, welcome back.
I wish.
Yeah. You know, I started off on this rant, and it started metastasizing. It started moving in all these different directions, and I wanted to bounce some of it off you. There's this piece over at Mediaite about how Ronan Farrow is probably going to get kicked off MSNBC. And, you know, that the business model was sort of the thing that Air America did when I left and they replaced me with Montel Williams. Find some guy who's got a name, put him on the air and give him $1 million.
Right.
And, you know, that's like kind of dumb programming. But it then leads to another question, and that is we didn't have the Fairness Doctrine from the founding of the Republic until the 1930s, and we did okay. But on the other hand, you could say, well, actually, we didn't do all that well. William Randolph Hearst and Frederick Remington brought us the Spanish-American War. You know, we had problems with our media forever. Or maybe not. And then the other thing is, you know, Fox is getting great ratings. MSNBC is not. Why? And I would suggest that there is this giant right-wing echo chamber that Fox is part of. It's basically a support network. I know right-wing talk show hosts who get all kinds of spiff deals. They get huge speaking fees. They write a book, you know, 10,000 copies, get bought by one of these right-wing foundations and passed out to WorldNet Daily to give away to get them on the New York Times list. And so they're building a constituency for, you know, in all pieces of it. As I was walking in the subway this morning, there was a guy standing there passing out free copies of the local Washington, D.C. right-wing newspaper, the daily right-wing newspaper, the little 24-page tabloid. There's no such thing on the left.
Right.
So let's have a conversation here in the 6 or 8 minutes we have about the state of media and why is it that Fox is getting good ratings and MSNBC isn't?
Well, I think that, you know, the comment that The Nation magazine, their motto is, like when George W. Bush was in power, Bush may be horrible for the country, but he's great for the nation, meaning The Nation magazine. The readership goes way up.
That's true.
It sometimes helps to be in opposition. I think MSNBC lost its way when it saw itself as defending the status quo, meaning defending the administration almost at all costs. And that isn't exactly exciting television.
Right.
To apologize, to be on the defensive, blah, blah, blah.
Well, and in fact, Limbaugh went on the air in 87. That was, you know, the end of the Reagan administration. But he really didn't catch fire until Bill Clinton became president in 92.
There's no doubt Clinton really helped him. But he was always doing well attacking the Democratic Congress.
Yeah.
I think talk radio and talk TV helps if you're on the attack, if you're on the offensive. If you're on the defensive, it's sort of demoralizing to your viewership. Fox News is never on the defensive. They could have all branches of government in their hands, and they'd be attacking some weak-kneed, soft judge in Topeka, Kansas.
Right.
You know, so talk radio and talk TV requires attack mode. It requires you to be on the offensive, criticizing something. And MSNBC has been apologizing for sometimes administration policies that are indefensible. And it didn't surprise me that over time people got tired of it. Yeah. As people lost hope in the or faith in or confidence in the Obama administration among moderates and liberals and progressives, I think MSNBC sort of lost their way doing the impossible.
Well, and they've also, I mean, you know, now that they're owned by Comcast, you will never hear and GE, you'll never hear a conversation on MSNBC about net neutrality, which I think is one of the biggest issues of our day. And you'll never hear an issue, a discussion on MSNBC about our trade policies, or at least an honest discussion about it, which I think is the, you know, one of the biggest things that's destroyed the middle class.
There's no doubt that I mean, I was over there, you know, in the in 2002 and 3 at MSNBC. There are some huge issues that are off limits. You know, Comcast has taken over from General Electric, but I remember wanting to talk about trade. It's just not an easy thing to do when General Electric owns the thing. And, you know, Olbermann used to be one of the great advocates for net neutrality. And he left just as Comcast was coming, because I think Olbermann felt, gee, I'm having trouble with General Electric being the boss. How am I going to survive when Comcast takes over? So there's no doubt that when you have corporate ownership, I mean, Tom, you're lucky you control your own shows.
Right.
But if you're at MSNBC, your paycheck comes from Comcast. And you know that there are serious issues, especially, you know, media conglomeration, that you have to avoid. And they do. But the other thing is, do you remember when Cenk Uygur was over at MSNBC briefly?
Right.
And he had good ratings. And they got rid of him because, as Cenk tells it, the management said to him something like, look, you can be anti-establishment when you're off on the web, but when you're here, you're part of the establishment. And I think what they were worried about is he was making it difficult for even even to book Democrats, because he attacked both parties.
Right. He was alienating the Chuck Schumer and Debbie Stabenow's of the world, the kind of, you know, middle of the road Democrats.
Yeah, he was attacking corporatism in both parties, and that's not what they wanted at MSNBC.
Right.
So even though he had good ratings, he was let go. Phil Donahue was the top rated show, and we were taking on the war when MSNBC didn't want us taking on the upcoming invasion of Iraq, and we were terminated when we were the most watched program. Olbermann was the most watched person on that network when he was gone. So, you know, if you keep doing that, you know, and you basically are operating in defensive apologetics mode, that just doesn't make good talk
radio
or TV.
So Fox News, and it's interesting, because the edge that I always see at Fox News is not so much that they are taking on the establishment, but that they are constantly proclaiming victimness on behalf of their viewers. We are all victims.
Yep.
And here's the people that we're the victims of. And here's the way that they are persecuting us. And particularly, you know, on behalf of, you know, white middle Americans. Right.
You know, there's no doubt about that. But again, I mean, I listen to you, Tom, and you talk about, you name the names. And here's the corporate trade deal that screwed the working class
right.
in this country. And you name the politicians of both parties. I mean, there's no doubt that that's better television and radio in this format, in the format of talk. You cannot be apologetic. And you raised another question about fairness doctrine. In the 19-teens, 20s, 30s, you had lots of newspapers in every single city. In New York, I think you had a dozen. I grew up in Detroit. I wasn't old enough to see it, but there were, I think, five or six dailies in the 20s, 30s.
Yeah.
You know, so there was a lot of competition.
Yeah.
The reason you need a fairness doctrine in broadcasting and radio and television is because it was a monopolistic medium, that if I didn't like what you were doing on a certain point in the dial, and I said, oh, I'm going to set up a radio station to counter what Tom Hartman's saying, and I didn't get a federal license, a monopoly license, I would have been put in jail.
Yeah.
So it was because of the limited number of stations.
So some of this goes back to Reagan stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Act in 82, and then all this sudden agglomeration of media as well.
Yeah, I think the biggest factor was the conglomeration of media, and it really went to the benefit of the right-wing attack folks.
Right.
I mean, the fact that a few corporations were taking over TV and radio, you know, they don't mind if they've got someone on the air who's always attacking gays or feminists or what have you. What they don't want on the air at these big corporations is someone who's speaking out for the working class and naming the names of corporations that are engaging in greed and corruption that hurts the broad public. Those are the kind of names you can't name.
Right.
And so it's never surprised me why talk radio in particular has tilted to the right wing. And it always did, even before it went national with Limbaugh, when it was local, even in liberal cities like New York, Los Angeles, Detroit, they would give the mics over to the right wing attackers who would attack every group in society except the big economic powers that often had power within the media itself.
Right. Yeah, and I've seen that with this program over the years, and you know, with my own persona, as it were. We've done really well with independent stations. We've got a couple of fairly large independent stations, Chicago, Minneapolis, that carry the show. They're doing fine. Clear Channel, on the other hand, most of the stations, they used to be the major carrier of progressive talk, and that's all gone.
Yeah.
And of course, that was Mitt Romney's company. I mean,
Originally Clear Channel started as a conservative company in Texas with the Mays, you know, Lowry Mays.
Sure.
And then you're right, Mitt Romney's private equity firm.
Bain Capital bought it.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So this is another piece of the puzzle. Talking with Jeff Cohen, I'm not sure where it takes us other than
well, I know where it takes us.
Okay.
You know, I may come across as being pessimistic and downbeat, but the reality is that independent non-corporate media is stronger than ever.
Oh, yeah.
And
Free Speech TV's numbers are exploding, for example.
Democracy Now!, Common Dreams, Truth Dig, the Tom Hartman Network, all your we're booming. You know, we can't compete with the, you know, NBC News yet, but the independent media are growing.
There you go. Jeff Cohen. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Jeff's website, Jeff Cohen, JeffCohen.org. We'll be back. And welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Teresa in Barrington, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on Roku. Hey, Teresa, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First-time caller. I noticed something this summer, past summer. I've spent a lot of time with my brother, and he lives like in the Burton, Flint area.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a big fan of fast food. Actually, he was. I think I've got him to drop it all. But I noticed like in all these different fast food chain restaurants, it's always Fox News playing.
Really? I haven't.
Really?
It's been years since, having been a vegetarian since I was 17. It's been a long time since I've walked into one of those places.
I don't eat stuff either, but I went, I would go in there with him. And I'm just like, why is this always on?
I see the same thing when Louise and I lived in Vermont and in Oregon. We used to do road trips from time to time, particularly in Vermont. Every Thanksgiving, we would drive back to Michigan and visit my family. And you hit truck stops, right? And along the way, they always had Fox News on, nothing else. And it's like,
these people that are just going in and out, they're just getting bits and clips of, whatever nonsense they're spewing.
Yeah. Well, and I think Jeff's point that there's a complaint and a victimness associated with it is a really important one. Teresa, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your observations with us. Kenyatta in Redlands, California, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, I just want to make a couple points here. You know, there's an ignorance matrix in this country. And, Plato said hundreds of years ago that the beginning of wisdom is a definition of terms. And, what Fox News does is, I try to stomach Fox every now and then, but what they do is they're appealing to very base, very rudimentary emotions in people. We have to remember that this is a country, and you've acknowledged this many times, that was essentially formed on racism.
Sure.
And, I have watched Fox News pander to this very base element almost every one of their broadcasts. You know, I was listening to Fox this morning, and they were talking about this young lady, this nurse that has contracted Ebola in Dallas, and she was, and I believe she is a hero. I think all health workers are heroes because I'm a lupus survivor, and I've had wonderful people in the medical profession in my life to keep me alive. But, you know, I was listening to this, and again, we throw around terms in this country, and none of us really looks at what they mean. And you and I have talked about this before. For instance, when I hear Ebola as a black man, I think of immediately, in the back of my mind, I hear the word ebony. I hear the word ebonics. And Fox really racializes this so-called scare.
Oh, now, why is it's the black disease coming to get us.
Yes. Why is it that this guy... that Duncan, unfortunately, who lost his life, he went over to Liberia to help people. Why was he not a hero? But this young lady is. So is heroism, and this is my question to you, Tom, is heroism in our parlance here in America, is it that you're a hero if you help certain people?
Well, I think you have his story wrong. He was a Liberian citizen who was coming to the United States. He had been here before. Was coming back to the United States to get married. But he was, you know, he did try to help a pregnant woman get to the hospital who was dying of Ebola, which is apparently how he was infected. But it wasn't like he volunteered to be a physician. But I think characterizing him as a villain is a horrible thing. Kenyatta, thank you for the call. Speaking of that whole victimhood thing, Kenyatta just called. I thought this was a fascinating perspective if you missed it. He said, speaking as an African-American, he was watching Fox News this morning, and the way that they're talking about Ebola, like ebonics, like ebony, like, you know, it's the black disease coming to get you white people in middle America, in Dallas, in the heart of middle America. Now, this is me. Yeah, exactly. The black disease is coming to get you. And I think that there's a fairly large piece of that. So, by the way, Sally Alice is on the line with us, walking the Granny D walk out of Albuquerque.
Yeah.
Am I right on with about that? Is this Sally Alice?
Do you have a speaker?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can hear you. Hello?
Hello?
Hello, Sally?
Yes, this is Sally Alice Thompson.
Hi, how are you, Sally Alice? You are walking in the memory of Granny D against money and politics. Do I have that right?
Against money and politics, yes.
Great.
And I am on North 4th Street in Albuquerque.
Uh-huh.
I 2 miles this morning, and I'm going to walk 4 more miles today.
That's marvelous.
And tomorrow is my birthday. I'm going to be 91 years old.
Oh, that's marvelous.
So I'm trying to alert people to the fact that we don't have to let the Koch brothers and the Ehrmans and the Waltons take over our country.
That is brilliant. Doris Haddock was a good friend of Louise and mine, and Granny D. That was her real name, was Doris Haddock, and she was marvelous. I am so pleased, Sally Alice, that you are standing up and doing the same thing. I honor you. Is there a website where people can keep track of what you're doing every day?
Yes, Sally-Alice-Thompson. Get them up.
I'm sorry.
Money out of politics.
Okay, and the website, people get to the website by going to where?
Sally-Alice-Thompson. Get them up.
Okay, great. I'm gonna put you on hold, and maybe if Lemoyne can pass some of that information along, so I can make it easier. We can get it on our website to promote it, and we can make it easier for people to get to you and find out what you're doing. I just want to say thank you for what you're doing, Sally Alice, and thanks for calling in.
Okay. Thank you. Here's Lemoyne.
Hang on just a second. Here's Danielle. And, yeah, okay. So back to this. Stephen, in Aberdeen, Maryland, you wanted to get back to the media.
Huh?
Stephen, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. How are you?
What my question is one of the things I think, you know, along the lines of the topic that you have here is that as far as progressives go, one of the things I think the right wing pretty much controls the narrative.
Yeah.
I'm thinking if there's a whole panacea, or not panacea, but at least a area that I think that progressives can get to that can help us. What I'm speaking to specifically is, why don't we talk about the dialectic and the dichotomies and a lot, you know, some of what your callers have been calling today talking about.
Yeah, I think, first of all, Stephen, I think what you'll find is that when you use words like dialectic and dichotomy, that a large portion of the American electorate doesn't know what you're saying, which is, you know, a tragic thing, but...
That's my point. And well, I'm not thinking that you should do shows on that specifically. What I'm saying, in terms of podcasts, I think.
But arguably, that's what I'm doing right now, Stephen. I'm just not using those terms.
I know you are, and that's what I mean. I think your audience is perfectly capable of.
I agree. On the other hand, I've just, you know, as a basic principle in both my writing and my media. And I have a pretty good vocabulary, I agree with Strunk and White, who wrote The Elements of Style, that if you can say something simply, it's better to say it that way than to say it in some complex fashion, unless you're writing a college term paper.
Well, it's just that I just think that I don't know, or is it your opinion that we already occupy that area, and that, well, your conversation today is about... you know, why the right wing does so well and the progressives do not.
Well, I'm not, you know, it's not, Jeff kind of recalibrated my thinking on this. He's, you know, he basically said MSNBC is not progressive media. You know, it's institutional Democratic Party media. And there are some progressive pieces within the institutional Democratic Party. But they without exception, they tend to be the ones that don't challenge wealth and power. They have to do with representing people of color. They have to do with representing people who are gay. They have to do with representing women. They have to, all of these things are, you know, they're noble efforts, and they're things that MSNBC is all over. But they don't cost any corporation any money at all. Whereas if they were to talk about what, in my opinion, and Bernie Sanders' opinion, and others like us, I think, you know, economic progressives, if we were to talk about the economic issues, where is unionization in the United States? Where is, you know, what about our trade policies? Why is Germany banned tuition for college, and we've got, you know, $1.2 trillion in student debt in the United States? You know, why are we giving billions of dollars to for-profit corporations to run voting machines and tell us how we voted? I mean, just core stuff that has to do with our democracy and having a functioning society that you will not hear in most of the so-called liberal media in the United States, because it offends advertisers, it offends big corporations, or it offends the people, the corporations that own the media. And I think that's a pretty big issue. Stephen, thank you for the call. We will continue to make those cases and to talk about those issues on an ongoing basis here on this program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And a few other things that I wanted to get into today. I find this a particularly interesting story. And I'm curious your thoughts on this as well. Voice biometrics. This is over at The Guardian right now. Their news technology. It's a story picked up by the Associated Press in London. The opening sentence, over the telephone, in jail, and online, a new digital bounty is being harvested. The human voice. Now, as I was walking to work this morning, got out of the train station. I mentioned on the way into the train station in the last hour, into the metro, the guy passing out the right-wing newspaper. When I got out of the metro and was walking over here to the radio studio, it's about a three-block walk, and I was dictating an email on my phone with Siri, right? It's an Apple iPhone. And Siri has learned how to recognize my voice. Well, it turns out that voices are like fingerprints. And Apple now has my voice. And in fact, some of these really large, Mike Galdoff, an executive with the Madrid-based company, Agnintio, one of about 10 leading companies in this field of harvesting voices, says we sometimes call it the invisible biometric. Dan Miller, an analyst, I'm reading from the piece in The Guardian from the Associated Press, Dan Miller, an analyst with Opus Research in San Francisco, estimates that the industry's revenue will roughly double from just under $400 million last year to around $900 million next year, $730 to $900. Barclays experimented with voice printing for its wealthiest clients. It was so successful, they're going to roll it out for their 12 million clients. Now, on the one hand, you know, hey, super convenient. You want to know what's going on with your bank, or you want to check your credit cards, or you want to check your, you know, fill in the blank. You want to buy something, you know, whatever it may be. Just say a word or two, and immediately you are identified. There's no doubt about whether your phone got stolen or whether the computer is or isn't yours or whether that's actually you standing in the bank. It's kind of the ultimate ID. Say hello. Because our voices are incredibly unique. And now there's a level of sophistication to the software that breaks out our voices that it's like, hey, this is your fingerprint. And there are companies harvesting these things. I mean, in a really big way. In South Africa, roughly 7 million voice prints have now been collected by that country's Social Security Agency, the police. In the U.S., law enforcement officials use the technology to monitor inmates and track offenders. The largest single implementation is in Turkey, where a mobile phone company called Turkcell has taken the voice biometric data of some 10 million customers. But government agencies are catching up, they say. What happens when there's no place, there's no possibility of being anonymous? I mean, on the one hand, life is getting convenient. When I visit the Amazon website, they know exactly what I want. When I visit any website, they know exactly what I want. They put ads up that are based on my browsing history. If you have a Gmail account or probably any other of the big email accounts that deliver ads in exchange for giving you free email, you discover that the things that you talk about in email, because they're reading your emails, the things you talk about in email are the things that get advertised to you. Say, hey, I'm thinking of buying a house, or hey, you know, my wife is pregnant, or whatever it may be, and suddenly you're getting ads for real estate companies and Pampers. Now, I'm not exaggerating. Is this a good thing? Or is this simply, this is the new America? Seems to me that it's more the latter, it's the new America. The CEO of Microsoft has some magical ideas about how to get women decent pay. We have a clip of this. Here is the CEO, Satya Nadella, telling women how to make sure that their pay keeps up with their male counterparts over at Microsoft. Here he is.
It's not really about asking for the raise, but knowing and having faith that the system will actually give you the right raises as you go along. Because that's good karma. It'll come back.
Right. Just trust the system. You know, like women have done for thousands of years as the property of men. Just trust the system. This is very strange. Meanwhile, what are we number one in? We have 88 guns for every 100 people. Lawrence Whitner, writing over at the History News Network, reprinted over at Alternet. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute says that we, the United States government, accounted for 37%, over a third of the entire planet's military expenditures. China and Russia account for 11 and 5% respectively. We're also the number one weapons exporter to the world. We have all these guns. By contrast, in Britain, there are 6 guns for 100 people, 1 gun-related death for every 400,000. We have 40 gun-related deaths for every 400,000 because we have 88 guns for every 100 people. Education, Program for International Student Assessment. Looks at a study, 15-year-old students, 65 nations. The U.S. ranks 17th in reading and 21st in math. In 2014, another company, a multinational education services company, rated us 20th for educational attainment, behind Poland and the Slovak Republic. Healthcare, even worse. We rank 30th in the world, according to the World Health Organization. Although we pay more for healthcare than any other country in the world, which brings us, and you know, it goes on and on, the environment, sanitation, water. You live in Detroit, you don't even have the right to water, according to the judge there in that bankruptcy. 38th in air quality, 36th in water sanitation, 35th in health impacts, 86th in biodiversity and habitats, 96th in fisheries, 107th in forests. Why is this? I would submit to you that the vast majority of these problems that we are seeing in the United States that make us number one in all the things nobody wants to be number one in, and number 10, 20, 30, 40 in the areas where people actually want to be number one, is because of laissez-faire, so-called free market economics. It's because of raw, naked, brutal capitalism. Because our country has been hijacked by a group of cranky billionaires and large transnational corporations who don't give a rat's ass about America. The billionaires don't care about the average American. It's all about making more money and getting more power. And the result of that is that human outcomes, like do we have a well-educated populace? Do we have a well-informed populace, apropos of our last hour? Do we have a healthy populace? Those things are irrelevant because those are not measures of profit. Reaganomics has turned this country into basically, I mean, this is the great experiment, right? Reagan came into office saying government bad, free market good. Let's turn it all over to the free market. Drop the top tax rate on the billionaires from 74% down to 28%. Turn them into job creators. Open our borders. Let's have free trade. Let's all this stuff. And now we see how it's working out. It's a disaster.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's a disaster brought to you by unregulated capitalism. Capitalism's okay if it's regulated, but unregulated capitalism destroys countries. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Colleen in Gig Harbor, Washington, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Colleen, what's up?
Oh, I was just calling about, good morning, by the way. Just
good morning.
Calling about the, you were talking about Tribune buying, or Fox buying the Tribune stations.
Right.
Earlier.
Yeah.
And what's going on up here is Fox does want to purchase, or not purchase, but trade some other stations from somewhere else for the stations up here in Seattle that are a Fox affiliate. And now they're, because Tribune has been playing hardball and wants more for the product than what Fox wants to give, they're threatening to pull the Fox affiliation away from the station here.
Really?
And they even went so far as to buy a small station up in Bellingham that's just an infomercial station at this time.
This is radio or television?
And it looks like extortion to me. I mean, they'll end up with the station because they'll devalue it so much if they pull the affiliation away that they won't be able to sell it to anybody.
Is this radio or television? Colleen, can you hear me? Colleen can't hear me. We had this problem.
No,
last week.
I can't.
Can you hear me now? No, apparently you can't.
Yes.
Okay, is this radio or television that you're talking about?
It's television.
It's television.
Actually, it's a large station in Seattle that also runs another station out of the same place, and they have a station that they run in Portland
right. That
is also run from Seattle. So it's a big deal, and we don't have Fox, per se, here in the Northwest, other than on your cable and satellite. The Fox affiliate doesn't run the Fox News. They may have a story that one of the national reporters does from somewhere else, but it's basically just local news, and I'm sure all that will change.
Well, we'll see. I mean, if Fox, if 20th Century Fox, I mean, they own the movie company, they own television stations, they produce shows. I think The Simpsons are produced by Fox, aren't they? And
they run that. That's the other thing. If they pull the affiliation, see, they'd lose all of the programming that they do carry.
Right. But, you know, I think that what the calculation that Rupert Murdoch has made is that he'll make his entertainment money in the entertainment areas, making movies and doing TV shows and owning that, you know, the television network and these affiliated stations, regardless of content, even in, you know, progressive areas, even fairly progressive content like The Simpsons. But in his effort to influence politics, you know, Roger Ailes, again, hatched the idea for GOP TV in the Nixon White House, pitched it to Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon was unable to raise enough money to make it happen. Roger Ailes eventually hooked up with a billionaire, Rupert Murdoch, who said, yeah, I can make that happen, and who lost $100 million a year for 5 years, making Fox News successful. They finally made a profit in their fifth or sixth year, but he lost hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, Air America lost $16 million, and that was it. That was the total. And you know, couldn't make it happen. So that's very interesting, very interesting. Colleen, thanks for the heads up on that. Thanks for calling. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Media for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here with you. And so let me just wrap this up. And lay it out. We have had these periodic cycles, and maybe I'm thinking about this. I just in this morning in the mail, or I guess yesterday it came in the mail, but this morning I opened the package before I left to come to work. I got a couple of copies of The Crash of 2016 in paperback. It's just been released by Hachette.
Let's see what's the imprint.
12 is the imprint that is owned by Hachette. And the the book, The Crash of 2016, The Plot to Destroy America and What We Can Do to Stop It. And I'm assuming that as the paperback will be hitting the bookstores in the next couple of weeks, and it's probably available now on online sources. And when I wrote that book, I really, really, really dug into, and you'll find it in the book, you know, the history of basically the right-wing takeover of America and how the right-wing takeover of America has done two things. And the first was, you know, clearly their goal. It has massively enriched very wealthy people and massively empowered large corporations against average working people. Whether it's unions or whether it's pollution, or you name it. Deregulation, tax cuts, these are the mantras of the Republican Party, and they have succeeded in imposing these on the American public, on the American people, over the past 34 years, successfully. Reaganomics has not been rolled back. Bill Clinton did not reverse Reaganomics. Barack Obama did not reverse Reaganomics. In fact, George W. Bush doubled down on Reaganomics. He had his own tax cut, which added another trillion to our budget deficit. So the first goal of Reaganomics, which was to enrich wealthy people and give money, excuse me, give power to big corporations, has been accomplished. Now, here's what's really interesting. A lot of this was accomplished because back in 1971, Lewis Powell wrote this memo to Eugene Sindor, his next-door neighbor and president or chairman or something, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, just a little before Richard Nixon put Powell on the U.S. Supreme Court. He wrote this memo saying, basically, look at what Ralph Nader is doing. Look at what Rachel Carlson is doing with Silent Spring and with Unsafe at Any Speed, and the lawsuits that are coming out about it, and even Richard Nixon buying into the idea of an EPA. Look at what's happening. If business doesn't fight back, we're going to be, you know, constantly paying up and regulated and hassled to death, and, you know, the unions are getting strong. We've got to do something. But when you actually read the writing, Lewis Powell's memo, when you actually read the philosophical underpinning of this stuff, Russell Kirk, The Conservative Mind in 1951, read William F. Buckley, what you get is that these guys, or for that matter, go back and read, you know, the early writings and campaign positions of David and Charles Koch back in the 70s and 80s when it was all about the Libertarian Party, or their father, Fred, when it was all about the John Birch Society. And if you go back and you look at it, what you see is that they're not saying we need to make rich people richer and powerful corporations more powerful and screw everybody else. They're not saying that. They're saying if we make rich people richer and we empower the corporations, if we create a country that is safe for billionaires in corporate America, it'll be a better country. Now, there are a lot of people who are pushing back on that and saying, no, it won't. The Keynesian economists, the Paul Krugmans of the world, the John Maynard Keyneses of the world. Keynes is gone. But yeah, there were a lot of people pushing back on that. But still, it was, you know, it was an interesting idea. I mean, if we had tried this laissez-faire libertarian economics from 1921 to 1929. It didn't seem to work all that well. But, hey, it was only 9 years. Maybe it was just an experiment that went wrong. Let's try it again, this time for 30 years. And what we know, and you know, I think some of them just didn't really care what the impact would be on average working people and on the middle class. Some of them actually probably agreed with John Maynard Keynes. It's going to screw working people, but, hey, tough luck. We're the billionaires, right? But a lot of them, I think, were actually idealists. I know my dad was. I mean, he wasn't a billionaire, but he went along with their prescriptions because he thought it would be the best thing for America. Some of their prescriptions. But now we've got the empirical evidence. We have 34 years, 33 years solidly of Reaganomics. We can look at it and we can see that it has destroyed our country. It has destroyed the middle class. It has destroyed an entire generation that over the last 20 years has graduated from college and now is carrying into the workplace a debt load that is larger than their parents had, my generation, when we bought our first houses in our 20s. The experiment of Reaganomics has failed. And yet, even in progressive media, long live Reaganomics, right? No.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think this is one of the problems that MSNBC is having, is that they won't discuss Reaganomics. They won't talk about these really serious issues. Reaganomics has failed. It's time to end it. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. Just a few other things here. The NIH, this Rachel Maddow's blog, Steve Bannon writing over there at msnbc.com/Maddow blog, I believe it is, says, we learned this week that the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention's emergency preparedness budget really has been cut roughly in half since 2006. Right. So, you know, it's like Reaganomics, austerity-nomics. Does it work? No. So then how do Republicans stay in power? Well, they try to suppress the vote. And here's an interesting study out of the University of Delaware. When they asked white people using a card, you know, if you check the box here on this card. Here's the survey. When the card had no picture on it at all, and they said, do you support voter ID laws? 67% of white people said yes. When the card showed a picture of a white person voting, and they asked white people, do you support voter ID laws? 67% of white people said, yes, I support the laws. No difference. When the picture showed a black person voting, and they asked white people, do you support voter ID laws? It went up to 73% who support voter ID laws. You tell me this is not all about race. Hey, it's time for a Fox News alert. Here we go.
Fearful and unbalanced.
News has never been softer.
The most distrusted name in news.
To be honest, I've never seen such dysfunction.
So, who is responsible for these outrages?
This is Fox so-called news.
We need a visual for that. All righty here. This from a Media Matters blog. Most of 2009. Well, actually, we have a clip here, don't we? Here's a clip of it. This is from Fox and Friends. Here you go.
So every time there's an incident like this, you see Thomas Frieden, the guy who heads up CDC. But is he the official? There he is right there. Is he the official Ebola czar? We probably need one. Because the president isn't, you know, he's not.
Senator McCall's calling for one.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we need an Ebola czar. Wait a minute. Wasn't it Fox that was all upset about czars before? You had Van Jones. He was the energy czar. Oh, my God. Well, he was a black guy, of course. But we can't have czars, right? It's wrong. Czars are what the Russians used to do. You can't have czars. It's a bad thing. It's not democratic. Small d democratic. So there's that. I mean, you know, half the Republican politicians in this town and certainly Fox News spent years, the first 4 years of the Obama presidency, trashing him for having czars. But here's where it gets really ironic. A year and a half ago, President Obama appointed Dr. Murthy to be the Surgeon General. Who would be the Ebola czar, right? I mean, the head doctor for the United States. What did the Republicans in the United States Senate do? They filibustered him. To this day, there is no Surgeon General. So, Steve Ducey over at Fox So-Called News, you want to know why you don't have a Ebola czar? Because the Republicans in the Senate filibustered it. Why did they do that? Because they committed at the caucus room conspiracy back on January 20th of 2009, the night that Obama was inaugurated, they committed to destroy his presidency by blocking everything he tried to do, even something as innocuous as having a Surgeon General. No, you're not allowed to have a Surgeon General. You're this nation's first black president. Are you kidding? Having a surgeon general? Or you're a Democrat. Are you kidding? Get something done? Anyhow, Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind?
Hi, good afternoon, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
I mean, I didn't even call in to talk about Fox, but, you know, here's my stab at it. The only reason why they're asking for a czar right now is probably because through their polling, or since it's, you know, they've been doing this since this administration, it's a tag that that Obama now has, or the Democrats now has. And they're going to use this forever. They're going to always say that we had a czar. And it started in the Obama administration.
Yeah.
But I really called in because this election is so important that I need every Democrat that can hear my voice, independent and even Republican, to understand that we need to vote and we need to make sure the Senate stays Democratic. If we can put a dent in any type of way in the House, we need to, because right now it's for the heart and soul of the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Basically, we're going to have judges that's going to be removed from this court. And the thing about this country, we're built on laws. And we look to the Supreme Court, even if we don't have to. I mean, or if we don't have to take a final word, we look for them on their final word and their final rulings. That's what really makes this country tick the way that it does.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
If we want a progressive stand, if we want to make this movement that we started about, you know, electing President Obama and rejecting what the Republicans did with George Bush, we have to complete it.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you, Charles. Well said. And everybody who is listening or watching should make sure that you're registered to vote. Find out where to vote. There's an election coming up in a couple of weeks. It's an important one. Charles, thank you. Well said. Maxine in Louisville, Colorado. Hey, Maxine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a comment on your comment on the biometrics.
Yeah, on voice prints, I guess they'd call them.
On voice prints. So this is interesting. I happen to be an independent market analyst for the biometrics industry. I have been one for more than a decade.
Whoa.
And my company's called Acuity Market Intelligence. We specialize in biometrics and identity-related technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually wrote a piece last week that is somewhat related, which is basically about how the biometric technology that is now being introduced to mobile phones actually has the potential to, for the first time, create consumer-centric privacy. In other words, privacy that is sort of in the direct privacy, which includes control and ownership of your own personal data and personally identifiable data, like financial transactions and records and things like that.
Well, typically we've done that with passwords.
Right. And the model for this, for a lot of this stuff, is that corporations own it, like credit bureaus, like financial institutions, like retail stores.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's all these breaches because people break into their system.
Right.
What biometrics has the potential to do, and we're starting to see this with Apple Pay, is actually allow you to control not only access to your device, but control access to your information. So that when you make a purchase with Apple Pay, the way they've designed it, they're going to send a token to make that purchase. They're not sending the credit card information.
I understand.
And this opens up an entire new way of thinking about the way we manage our information. Now, people tend to see biometrics, oh my God, it's scary, it's my personal information. You know, and the thing about biometrics is it is personal, but it's not really secret.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We use our voices, our faces are out everywhere in the world. Even our fingerprints, technically, we leave them around. And if we can construct systems, which Apple in a way is starting to do, that allow you to use biometrics essentially as the lock
right.
for your information. Right.
The fingerprint reader for the new iPhone.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And they've been doing voice for a long time, but it's the same kind of thing where you say, I'm going to use biometrics, whether it's my voice or an image of my
finger. So the net on this, Maxine, would be that this is, like most technologies, it is not inherently good or evil. It is merely a tool. It's a more sophisticated tool. And the question ultimately is going to be, is industry or is government going to use this tool in ways that promote our privacy, that enhance our security, or in ways that reduce our privacy and diminish our security. And if we look at tools like just web browsers, for example, which were supposed to give us access to all the information in the world, now we discover that they're principally used to violate our privacy. They're used to track us everywhere we go so that people can sell things to us.
Right. Right, but what's so interesting about what Apple has done with their new privacy statement, which they're basically saying is we're not using our clients' information to monetize our relationship with them.
Right.
We have embedded security into our new iPhone 6 that does not allow us to comply
right.
with government subpoenas.
Right.
We can't do that. So what they've done
because the revenue model has become we'll make money off the hardware rather than the selling the information.
That's what they've done.
Yeah.
They've become one of the wealthiest companies in the world doing that. Well, if you look at companies like Facebook and Google, their inherent model is built on the idea of how do we monetize personal information. And so this is an opening in a way to shift that model on its head and say, you know what, that's not how we're going to do it. And if consumers respond to Apple, if consumers say, you know what,
But Maxine, we're about to hit a break here. Just a real quick question. Would you be not concerned about the day coming when you call into a talk radio show and say something that might be unfavorable, say, to the administration? Not something illegal, but just, you know. And immediately, because they can recognize your voice, they've got computer, the computer pops up and says, oh, that's Maxine. She lives in this town. Here's her address. Here's her, you know, here's all the information about, you know, suddenly it gets added to your dossier. Does that not concern you?
I know. I guess in a way, but you know, when I call your phone, I call you sure to say, "Hey, Maxine, so you already know who I am."
Right, we've got caller ID.
Right. So I think that I don't think it's a trivial issue. I think that for our concerns, I actually believe this technology can empower people. It can be used.
I agree. The question is who's going to be making those decisions? That and I don't think we know yet. Maxine, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, this is another example of why you have regulation of the commons or of the behavior of corporations, and why, of course, they try to buy the regulation they want. And welcome back, Jared, watching Free Speech TV on cable in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Jared, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I would like to go back to your last hour.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
We were talking about an informed populace. I'd like to talk about the reporting on the Malaysia Air crash, the Ukraine, and now Ebola. I'm not sure that there's a hell of a lot of difference with CNN, MSNBC, and Fox. They're all sort of screaming, your hair's on fire.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great, huge danger. Things, they're so far, all of them, I think, are pretty far to the left. Excuse me, pretty far to the right, which makes your show stand out.
Okay, thank you. I think that our show merely reflects where most of America is at. I mean, when you poll Americans, and Bernie's really good on this stuff, you poll Americans, you find, 88% of them think Social Security should be strengthened and benefits should be increased. More than 80% think that Medicare should be strengthened and benefits should be increased. More than 70% of Americans think that we should have a national health care system like other developed countries do. In some surveys, as many as 90% of Americans are wary of these so-called free trade agreements. I mean, you could go through the list, which seems to be a punch list of radical liberal policies. And in fact, they're all right where middle America is. This is a center left country with a center with a right wing media.
Right. And I think what the general population wants is straight reporting. I mean, sort of a la Spiegel or CBS, the BBC. I think when you listen to the the corporate news media, you just don't really get you get such a slanted set of facts.
You get the corporate voice. You could build a case that the Fox versus MSNBC wars, if you want to call them that, are really corporate Republicans versus corporate Democrats, and we're never stepping outside the box of the corporate voice.
No, I'd say that they're more like corporate Republicans versus corporate Republicans.
Mm.
I think they're all so skewed. And CNN just amazes me. I think as an informed populace, we just aren't.
Yeah.
And I think it's really scary, which is why I enjoy free speech TV.
Yeah, yeah, me too. And it's one of the reasons I think free speech TV is so critical, a part of our media infrastructure.
Yeah, and going back to what the gentleman was saying before, the importance of this election, it's not who the next president is. It's who the next Supreme Court is.
Yeah, yeah, especially since the Supreme Court has taken onto themselves the power to basically be superior to both the presidency and Congress.
Yeah. Well, I would say that the presidency and the Congress have abdicated their power.
Yeah. Yeah, over a period of two centuries. I agree with you. Jared, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Burlington. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Free-Don.org. I just got an email from Free-Don.org, by the way, from Don Siegelman. His appeal has been postponed until January. It's a big deal. You need to check it out. But let's check in with Victoria Jones, who is in the tastefully appointed White House luxury Talk Radio News broom closet. Hey, Victoria.
Here it is. Here in its glory.
Here it is. Oh, we get to see pictures of it. How cool is that?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So what's going on in the world today?
A great deal. As always, it just never stops. President Obama will be joining a meeting at Andrews Air Force Base this afternoon, which is being chaired by Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Martin Dempsey, and consisting of about 21 defense chiefs of countries around the world, including a large number of Arab countries, countries from Europe, Canada, Australia, and of the Arab countries, the key countries of Saudi Arabia and Turkey will be present. I think Turkey is going to be wrapped over the knuckles by a number of countries.
This is all about ISIS.
This is all about ISIS, yes.
Yeah.
And the meetings will probably go on for a couple of days, although President Obama will just be there this afternoon. This is part of determining the broader strategy against ISIS in Iraq and in Syria. And there will be questions, of course, as to Turkey's role, as Kobani looks like it's getting close to falling, although Kurdish fighters today say they have recaptured a strategically important hilltop west of Kobani on Syria's border with Turkey. The advance is made after a series of airstrikes by the U.S.-led coalition. Nevertheless, ISIS is thought to hold about half of the town of Kobani, from which between 160,000 and 200,000 Kurds have fled into Turkey. There are about 700 people left there. Refugees who have left and have made it into Turkey are reporting horrors. They're reporting hundreds of decapitated bodies, bodies with arms and legs chopped off, animals decapitated, people stolen, women, girls stolen, and also people, dead people with their eyes gouged out and their tongues cut out. So there is indeed a massacre going on in Kobani right now. And then meantime, Turkish warplanes yesterday bombed the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, rebel targets in Hakkari province near the Iraqi border, causing what they call heavy casualties. Now, if it's confirmed, this would be the first major air raid by Turkey on the PKK since a ceasefire was reached in March in 2013. So it would seem that they're taking advantage of what's going on to launch a raid on the
right. The PKK are the Kurds who are advocating a Kurdish homeland within Turkey.
Right.
And Turkey has identified them as rebels and terrorists.
Right.
But the PKK is also fighting against ISIS.
Right.
And now Turkey is bombing the PKK. The right. enemy of our enemy has become the, I mean, this, the, that cliche has lost all its meaning.
Exactly. And it seems as though Turkey seems to have made a determination, because they are not stepping in to help the Kurds in Kobani. They are literally standing and watching what is happening, literally, because it's so close. Seems to have made a determination that they would rather see the Kurds massacred because they hate them so much, and then deal with ISIS later, which may be a miscalculation, because they may not be able to deal with ISIS later.
Yeah.
Because if they help the Kurds, they would have to arm the Kurds and risk those Kurds having arms if they then decided to go for independence.
Right. This really demonstrates how this is a regional issue. And I had a call earlier. Yesterday, I went off on a rant about how Christopher Columbus was the ISIS of his day. You know, he came over here and robbed, raped, and pillaged. And if we saw somebody doing what he did over, you know, 30-year period, he killed every indigenous person on the island of Hispaniola, over a million, according to his brother, that we would be bombing them from the air. But somebody called up and said, no, here's the difference. Christopher Columbus was a European explorer, imperialist, whatever you want to call it, who was, you know, killing indigenous people. ISIS is the indigenous people. These are, by and large, Syrians and Iraqis, and we're getting ourselves in the middle of a fight between indigenous people and local governments that have historically been supported by the United States, Russia, and other non-Middle Eastern actors. It's very messy. Very messy.
Very messy indeed. So, it definitely is. Yeah.
So, what's the latest on Ebola? Has anybody yet asked Rick Perry, are you considering insuring the 6.5 million Texans who do not have health insurance? Are you considering expanding Medicaid now that you have Ebola in Texas?
Yeah, you asked about that question last week. I'm still not aware of anybody asking him that question.
Astounding.
But they may have done. It just may not have been reported. A local report. There are some good reporters in Texas.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's just, you know,
so
it may be that Rick Perry's not answering questions, too. Yeah, it'd be interesting to ask Greg Abbott that question.
Yeah, it's possible. Well, the death toll from the Ebola outbreak has risen to 4,447, most victims in West Africa. The World Health Organization is warning there could be up to 10,000 new cases per week within 2 months if global efforts are not stepped up. Also, the infection, the death rate has gone up to 70% from 50%. Now it's being described as a high mortality disease. So this is very worrying to the World Health Organization. Two-thirds of Americans believe the U.S. should restrict travel from Ebola-stricken nations, and there is also broad support for increased screening at airports.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable, at least the latter part. You know.
Just very briefly, Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut is urging the National School Boards Association to end its partnership with Big Tobacco in anti-smoking campaigns.
Oh, that's a good plan. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
It's always great to see you. Thank you for calling in from the White House. We'll be back. It's just coming up on the top of the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. and EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Some very interesting... This is... You know, I've often told you I like to read the Financial Times. I used to like to read the Wall Street Journal before Murdoch bought it and turned it into basically a right-wing rag. But I like to read the Financial Times because it's your opportunity. It's all of our opportunity to read what rich people are saying to each other. And it was in the Financial Times years ago that I first discovered that the U.S. housing starts were crashing. And that's when in 2007, late 2006, I started saying there's a stock market crash coming. Look out. The front page, or at least the digital front page of today's Financial Times, and this is not a plug for the Financial Times. Let me just, I don't get anything from them. In fact, I pay them to subscribe to their newspaper. But the front page electronic story has two stories back to back that I think should cause us all to go, really? And, I had an interesting conversation. I was in Vegas last week, as you know, and thanks again to Mike and Shane and Danielle and Leslie Marshall for filling in for me. And one of the topics that kept coming up everywhere I went, we were at Mike Papantonio's conference for the conference for lawyers, basically. But a lot of these people are fairly high net worth, and one of the topics that kept coming up was, is the stock market about to collapse? And person after person was like, I'm out of the market, I'm now entirely in bonds, or I'm entirely in cash, or whatever. Okay, here are the headlines over at the Financial Times. And no, this is not a plug for my book, The Crash of 2016, which is now coming out in paperback shortly, but maybe it should be. Fear gauge highest since Eurozone panic, reads one headline. The subhead is rise in volatility driven by worries over global economic recovery. And the other is steel in China is now cheap as cabbage. Country's annual consumption may fall for first time in 19 years. Now, let me unpack these. This fear gauge is a measure of volatility. Volatility is a measure of, how rapidly and how extensively changes are happening in the stock market. Stock markets traditionally are fairly stable places, but when they start moving in large ways without necessarily good reasons, that's called volatility, and it's like that's a good sign that it's not a good place to be, shall we say. Now, the question then is why? And you heard me in the last hour talk about how Reaganomics, this idea that we should simply turn our economy over to the billionaires and the big corporations, deregulate things, reduce the regulations on pollution, reduce the regulations on financial institutions, reduce the regulations on manufacturers, reduce the regulations in the workplace, make it easier for big corporations to show larger profits, even if that means that more people die of cancer, more people die of asthma, more people have their fingers cut off in the workplace or die in other workplace accidents, people don't get decent pay, they don't have none of that counts, because what's really important in the minds of the Reaganomics guys, and keep in mind, we are still in the era of Reaganomics. We have been for 33 years. What's important to economics guys is how are the billionaires doing? How are the big corporations doing? because everything else drips off that table. It's all about trickle down. Set a huge table for really rich people, and, you know, the crumbs will fall on the floor for the rest of us. So, number one, I read this as rich people, the Financial Times, basically saying to other rich people, look out. You know, if you think you can time the top of the market, good luck with that. But now comes the reason. Steel in China is now as cheap as cabbage. What does that mean? It means that they were building things like crazy in China, and they're not anymore. The subhead is country's annual consumption may fall for the first time in 19 years. The old joke used to be when America economically gets a fever, China or Japan catches cold. Right back in the 90s, when everybody was concerned about the rise of Japan, and Japan is becoming the new world power, and Japan now owns Rockefeller, you know, 30 Rock, and the Japanese own this, and the Japanese own that, and they got kind of burned. They bought a lot of stuff at the top of the market. But they were quite wealthy at the top of the market, too. Well, I think we can reverse that now. Back in the 90s, what China did didn't much matter to the United States. But now, you know, 20-some-odd years on, as a consequence of 25, 30 years, well, 30-plus years, of Reaganomics and free trade policy, much of the wealth of the United States has been moved to China. Whether it was, you know, Mitt Romney's company, Bain Capital, buying up that company in Ohio. What was it, Sensata? Sensata was the company. We interviewed one of the women who worked there, and she told us how the Romney guys came in and said, "Okay, we're breaking this factory down brick by brick and shipping it off to China, and you're going to have to train your replacements, your Chinese replacements." And this kind of an economic policy that has caused us to lose 60,000 factories since the day George W. Bush walked into the White House. And it's still going on. And by the way, I know that, you know, there's a lot of people who will say, "Oh, yeah, blame Obama for that one, too." Well, actually, Nancy Pelosi got out of the House of Representatives during the first 2 years of the Obama presidency, when we had a Democratic House and Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House. She got legislation out of the House of Representatives that did away with the tax incentives to move your jobs to China, out of the United States, to do what Bain Capital, what Mitt Romney did. Did away with those tax incentives and replaced them with reverse incentives. In other words, it said, "Hey, you want a tax break? Cool, we'll give you a tax break. Bring your jobs home. Move that factory, move that Sensata factory from China back to Ohio. You can have a tax break." It was the first attempt at a major reversal of Reaganomics and the so-called free market economy, so-called free trade economics, I think since 1981. And it went to the Senate, where more than half the senators voted in favor of it, which according to the Constitution should mean it's law. And it goes to the president's desk to be signed, but Republicans filibustered it. Mitch McConnell and the Republicans filibustered that legislation in the United States Senate. So the jobs are still in China. But anyhow, so China now has a middle class of over 300 million people. China's middle class is now larger than the entire population of the United States. So when the Chinese economy stops growing, it whacks the world. It hits the world upside the head. So between what's going on in the Middle East, what's going on in China, the failure of 34 years of Reaganomics, we got some serious challenges here. I think we're up to them, but they're serious challenges.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And now is the time to wake people up to how destructive corporatism and Reaganomics actually are. And welcome back, John, in Makawao, Hawaii, watching us on Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Am I saying your town right, John?
Yeah, it's pronounced Makawao.
Okay.
It's a cute little old cowboy town up on the side of a volcano. It's really quite beautiful. You should come, Tom. When you come, you can stay at my house if you like.
Well, thank you, John.
Hey, I just wanted to go over some things that you kind of alluded to a little bit this morning, and then one of your callers did too, and that, you know, I watch MSNBC, I watch Fox News, and I watch you. And I don't know, 6 months ago I started thinking, well, why is MSNBC doing this, and why are they saying that? And then as time has progressed, it's gotten worse, and this is my opinion. I think that MSNBC is actually a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican Party. I think it's a shill. Remember Hannity and Holmes, or Combs, whatever the guy's name was, who never could win a debate with Hannity? It's the same thing. MSNBC presents a very weak Democratic side, but always defers back to the Republican Party lines. They continually repeat the talking points of the Republicans. As a matter of fact, this morning, all they could seem to do was talk about Alison Grimes and her failure to admit that she voted for Obama. They don't bring up any of the crummy stuff that the other side has to say or do. It's always a hit on Obama and the Democratic side, and then they act like they're being Democratic progressive when they're not at all.
Well, the number one show is their morning show. It's Joe Scarborough, who's a right-wing, you know, a right-wing Tea Party. Well, he wasn't, the Tea Party wasn't around, but a, you know, right-wing congressman, you know, who. Well, whatever. I don't want to
exactly.
get into trashing
in person. Happened when the guy, Meet the Press, left and they appointed
David Gregory.
Chuck Todd.
Yeah.
Chuck Todd is, I think Chuck Todd, at least wise, Joe Scarborough's up front about that he's a Republican. Chuck Todd, they act like he's a Democratic left-wing guy. In fact, he's worse than Joe Scarborough. So they give him a bonus. Here, you can have the Meet the Press show because you'll be more anti-Obama, anti-Democratic than even the guy that was like Dick, whatever his name, Gregory was.
Yeah.
So it's like, at first I was confused. I was very upset about it. And then when I began to realize what they were really doing was I realized, well, I don't need to watch this program anymore. I can just go straight to Fox News if I want to hear this kind of stuff.
Let me posit a frame for this, John, that I think maybe you're missing. It's not that MSNBC or Fox, for that matter, or the CBS, ABC, CNN, NBC, that they are Democratic or Republican. It's that it transcends party. It's that they are pro-corporate. And so MSNBC will speak in favor of gays. They'll speak in favor of African Americans. They'll say the things that don't hurt corporate America that are, quote, liberal. And Fox will go to the things that don't hurt corporate America. You know, they try to be populist, right? The Tea Party, it's all about the people. So they'll talk about gay marriage and things like that. But they're not going to talk about economic populism on the right, which is very opposed to free trade. Just like MSNBC is not going to talk about economic populism on the left, which is very opposed to free trade. They're both representing the corporate viewpoint. Makes sense?
Even taking that a step further, because I kind of agreed with that, and I started wondering about it, though, and it was like, why would you, like when I first started watching MSNBC, why they had the so-called, self-proclaimed, the Reverend Al Sharpton on? I don't, listen, Reverend Al Sharpton can call himself a I am very suspicious of anyone that calls himself a reverend. That's just my personal opinion.
Well, he's been preaching since he was a kid, but John, thanks a lot for the call. I'm not going to pick on any individuals there. We'll be back 20 minutes past that. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. And let me just get back to this. I mean, this Microsoft CEO saying, hey, women, you know, just don't ask for raises. Karma will fix everything for you. There is a through line to all of this stuff. And the through line is one of aristocracy. This is what, in the early days of our republic, the founders of this republic, the largely white and somewhat affluent, none of the people who signed the Declaration or the Constitution were genuinely rich by today's standards. None of them came even close to Koch brothers' wealth. None of them came, I mean, literally not even close. The richest guy who signed the Declaration of Independence was John Hancock. He was the wealthiest of the founders. And in today's dollars, his net worth was about $700,000. He would be today, I mean, if he just was a homeowner in Los Angeles, that's what he would be, right? So it wasn't, but there was, on the one hand, there was the, oh, we want to be like aristocrats. You know, Thomas Jefferson wanting to serve the finest wines and, you know, people having nice homes. And, of course, it was supported and made possible, at least in the South, by slavery. And arguably by, in the North by slavery, because the wealth of the North came from the South, or much of it. Which, you know, if you go to elementary school in Atlanta, Georgia, like my kids did, you discover that that's why the Civil War happened, because the people in the South were tired of being ripped off by the Northern bankers. Right. Well, it wasn't that simple, but still. We've always had this weird love-hate relationship with wealth and celebrity. Louise and I went, when we were in Vegas last week, we went to a Shania Twain concert. Country music. She put on a hell of a show. It was a great show. And she has an amazing story. I mean, it was poor, literally poor girl. I mean, dirt poor from Timmins. I've been in Timmins. Timmins is just south of the I was going to say the Great Slave Lake, but it's not. It's near Moosonee, you know. It's the James Bay, I think it's called. It's been a long. Louise and I were there for our fifth, as I recall, wedding anniversary. Flew up at an old DC-3 where they passed out blankets to keep us warm because there was no heat in the airplane. I mean, it's way up there. And, you know, it's poor, poor, poor area. And she grew up in this area, and now she's sold more records than, I mean, number one country singer in the world. And during the show, she comes out in the audience. And just, you know, as she's singing a song, walking around, putting her arms around people, hugging people, doing selfies with people. And then she brought a bunch of audience members up on stage. And they were just all kind of falling all over. Oh, my God, it's a celebrity. We have this very strange relationship with wealth and celebrity in the United States. There's part of us as the rebels who fought off aristocracy, the British aristocrats, you know, in the Revolutionary War, there's part of us, part of our DNA is that we oppose wealth and aristocracy and celebrity, that we're egalitarian. I mean, the principles, the Enlightenment principles upon which this country was founded were egalitarian. They were of the fundamental equality of humankind. Even though in 1776, it didn't apply to blacks in the South, it didn't apply to women. In most places, there were many places where women did vote. Up until around 1800, by that time it was pretty much gone. But still, our national mythology, and there's a certain amount of truth to it, is that we stood up to the British East India Company, the largest corporation in the world. We stood up to the British Army, the British Empire, the largest army in the world. We kicked their butts. And we created a nice, friendly nation for ourselves. And the first person who had a net worth in the United States, the really rich people fled during the Revolutionary War. I write about this in my book on equal protection, the Johnson, or actually in What Would Jefferson Do? It's where most of this is to be found. The Johnson family had this giant castle on the Hudson River with 200. They had brought over indentured servants from Europe. They had basically white slaves who were dressed in armor and in the uniforms of the Roman and Greek Empire. You know, it was incredible. They fled to Canada. during the Revolutionary War. They were with the British, right? Hey, wealth and power. So we have this weird relationship with wealth and power in the United States. And it's a challenge for us to reconcile ourselves to this. The way, you know, I think it's been a challenge, frankly, for this administration. Do you take on the banksters? Do you take on Jamie Dimon? The guy's a billionaire. Or do you let him just pay a fine and, you know, not go to jail when he and his bank have committed crimes, actual crimes, that have caused people to lose their homes, to lose everything, to get divorced, to have suicides? What do you do? Oh, well, they're wealthy and rich. That's redundant. Wealthy, rich, and powerful and famous. I think that we're starting as we approach, and I think we saw the beginnings of this with both the Tea Party movement and the Occupy movement, that we are starting as a country to wake up and to realize that the interests of the billionaires are not the interests of the average American. Drudge has on their homepage right now a link that says if you have more than $3,000 and change in wealth, a little over $3,000, you are among the 50% of the richest people on the planet. Well, it's true. Because 2 billion of us live on less than $2 a day. But it's a great way to divert the fact, to divert attention away from the massive amount of wealth accumulated by people like the Koch brothers.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the fact that much of that wealth is being used to pit Americans against Americans so that the wealthy can get richer. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Non-disparagement causes. This is a very thought-provoking piece by Raphnell Haraldson over at Politicus USA, titled Non-Disparagement Clauses in the Path to GOP Corporatist Tyranny. This is a fast, I'll get to this tomorrow, I think, in more detail. It's an interesting place to go. Bob in Marseille, Illinois. Hey, Bob, what's up?
I don't know if this is going to work because I've been beating on my cell phone and I can't get it off speaker. The only thing I really wanted to say was about the consolidation of the media. Mm-hmm. And I heard something disturbing yesterday, and that was iHeartRadio was part of Clear Channel. And I've always been worried about streaming because streaming it definitely eliminates your anonymity altogether. I don't care. I prefer to be anonymous when I'm listening. I never say anything without try and be anonymous.
Yeah, just for the record, Bob, iHeartRadio is a brand that is owned by Clear Channel and only points to Clear Channel stations, as far as I know. At least that was the case back when I used to work in a Clear Channel station a couple of years ago. And on the other hand, TuneIn Radio has a channel called Progressive Voices, which is from progressive stations and things like that. And a lot of stations have their own websites. I mean, you're listening on WCPT. A lot of people stream from WCPT from all around the country. I get calls from all over the country, people listening to WCPT.com.
When I heard that about Clear Channel and iHeart, I was thinking that if you're going to stream, you're probably better off getting as close to the source as possible. But it is disturbing that the statistics and anybody that can gather statistics can get personal information. The statistics are available not only to the people here at my DSL provider, but also at the streaming source.
Right. And yeah. Who's listening to what, when, and all that sort of thing. Bob, excellent points all. Thank you for the call. Joe in Phoenix, listening to KPHX, another independent station that we're proud to be on. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, how are you? I just wanted to compliment you on your RT show. Why do you not publicize that on the radio? I
don't think we don't.
What?
I don't think we don't. We used to do a whole segment on it. Anyhow, thanks for the kind words. By the way, I want to mention something about Clear Channel. We were, for 2 years, I believe it was. It might have been longer than that. It might have been 3 or 4 years. I was on a Clear Channel stay. I was an employee of Clear Channel, as well as Clear Channel providing me with a space to do my national show out of when we were in Portland. And it was KPOJ was the station. It's no longer there. It's flipped to sports, as so many of the progressive stations have across the country, the Clear Channel stations. But the one thing that I always thought was really interesting was that when I was with Air America, it was not uncommon for management to call me up and try to pitch things to me. Hey, would you get this guest on? Can you do this? We had a contract, it literally written into our contract, and I have this in our licensing agreement with RT. We have this with Westwood One for this show. We literally have always written into our contracts that we have complete editorial independence. And nobody from Clear Channel ever told me what to say or what to do. Ever. And I have a similar experience with RT, where we do a TV show in the evening. Nobody ever says, hey, would you do that? Don't do that. Whatever. On the other hand, I always thought it was funny that when I was on Air America, I got harassed by management. Hey, why are you covering this? Because it's my show and this is what I'm doing. So anyway, just for what it's worth, I get it. Clear Channel is about making money. God bless them. And I think, frankly, that they'd make a lot of money if they had more progressive stations. But they've not decided that. But they've got a couple of really good progressive stations. Their station in Madison, in particular, excellent one, the mic. And also in Albuquerque, New Mexico, we're on there. Matthew in Springfield, Virginia. Hey, Matthew, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to point out that the media changed, and our perception of it changed in the aftermath of the Vietnam War. Do you recall when Walter Cronkite went into Vietnam and made reports from there right after the Tet Offensive in 67 and famously said that he didn't see the light at the end of the tunnel?
Yes.
And that was considered a kind of betrayal by the right wing, and that ever since then they looked upon mainstream media as somehow complicit in losing the war. And I think that
Well, let's keep in mind, there was a Democrat in the White House at that time. So it wasn't just right wing. it was the whole establishment, basically.
Yes, and what happened is that they wanted to have this other voice. So from that day to this, now we have people who are proudly saying that they never listen to the mainstream voices in the media because they're not to be trusted.
Right.
And including people in my family who keep telling me that they would never listen to ABC and all those commies over there. I just feel as though once upon a time we all listened to the same three broadcasts on those right before dinner and 30 minutes at a time. We would all sit down. There was Chet Brinkley. There was Uncle Walter. And at least we could argue with all the same amount of facts in hand. But we don't do that anymore.
Yeah, and because of the Fairness Doctrine, all three of those networks, their news divisions were completely independent and autonomous. They were staffed by news people. They were committed to delivering the news. It didn't matter what it cost. It didn't matter who it embarrassed. It didn't, I don't want to wildly exaggerate it, but I was there. I was in that business. And there was a real, genuine commitment to news. That went out the window in 1987 when Reagan did away with the Fairness Doctrine, and the first network to move their news division under the vice president to basically take the vice president of news and make him subordinate to the vice president of entertainment programming. The first network I recall that did that was CBS, and the other two networks, probably within weeks, if not months. And things have changed, and I think Cronkite's reporting may have played a real pivotal role in it. It might have been one of the things that informed the Lewis Powell and the whole Powell memo thing. Matthew, thanks for pointing that out, and thanks for listening to SiriusXM. Richard, driving through Iowa, listening to SiriusXM. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. How are you today, sir?
I am well. How about you?
I'm doing good. You know, I grew up listening to an artist named Gil Scott Heron, who I believe you might be familiar with.
Yes.
You know, and when I sit back and I listen to his music, you know, this guy, you know, most of his stuff you're familiar with is more of a social commentary type thing than it is just pure entertainment.
Yes.
And, you know, the things that are even going on today, this guy was almost like a Nostradamus of his time because, you know, he predicted through his music, like, the fall of the city of Detroit. Back in the 70s, he had a song out called We Almost Lost Detroit, where he saw Detroit starting to crumble then.
Yeah.
You know?
I got to go back and listen to some of that music. It's been a long time. But, you know, I believe you. I think, by the way, We Almost Lost Detroit was the title of a very popular book that came out in either the late 60s or early 70s because the nuclear power plant in Detroit almost melted down. And we almost lost Detroit to a nuclear power plant as well. But Richard, excellent point. Thanks for calling and making it. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to point out that Bill Clinton and the Democrats did partially reverse Reaganomics by raising taxes on high-income people around 4%, and the results were spectacular.
Yes.
Deficits turned into surpluses, 23 million jobs created, rising wages. I mean, I don't understand how you can ignore the most, the best economic expansion during peacetime in history.
Well, I would say, one, it was in large part a bubble. And two, you are right. Clinton did raise or oversaw the raising of top marginal tax rates by about 4%. But let's keep in mind, Reagan had dropped them from 74% down to 28%. And then during the Reagan and Herbert Walker Bush presidencies, it got raised back up to 32, 33, maybe 34%. I forget, it was somewhere in that neighborhood. Clinton came in and he only raised it by 4 points. To really roll back Reaganomics, it has to be over 50%. And this is, you know, there's a whole chapter about this, a book I wrote called Rebooting the American Dream. The math is in. When you pay more than 50% in taxes after you make about $2 or $3 million a year in income, then you don't end up with bubbles. And the reason is simple psychology. If money is dear, if money is hard to get, people invest cautiously. They invest wisely. If money is hot, if money is easy to get, if the top tax rate is not over 50%, regardless of how many millions of dollars you make, and even during Bill Clinton's time, the top capital gains tax rate never went above 20%, then what you end up with is hot money. Hot money creates bubbles. And I would say that much of the so-called Clinton prosperity was not structural prosperity. It was a bubble. Paul, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That said, Bill Clinton raising taxes on the rich and the world not coming to an end, in fact, things working out fairly well, does repudiate Reaganomics at the least. And welcome back. Joe, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Rosemont, California? Rosemont?
Yes, Rosemont. Exactly.
So what's up?
I was going to rail about Fox News and what's going on with MSNBC, but I think you rode that horse till it's dead.
Okay.
I heard you while I was waiting talk to the lady who mentioned the Kurds and the PKK and the Peshmerga.
Oh, yeah.
And I was there at the end of the Gulf War, and we were operating the no-fly zone in northern Iraq.
Uh-huh.
One of the things we did was train Peshmerga. We gave them weapons, trained them, and the hope was that they would go into Iraq and take care of Saddam.
Right.
What happened, they turned on the Turks.
Right.
And so we quit that whole program.
Yeah.
I think with all this talk about ISIS and that we should arm the Syrian rebels, I think the same thing will happen.
Yeah. Bernie Sanders was so right when he was on CNN on Sunday and said, you know, everybody forgets this all started with George W. Bush invading Iraq. And in fact, I would say it all started with George Herbert Walker Bush invading Iraq. And we should have just let Saddam Hussein take Kuwait and say to the emir and the daughter of his diplomat who came over here and lied and said she was a nurse and that they were throwing babies out of incubators, we should have said, you know, tough luck. But, Joe, what a lot of Americans don't realize, and I'm sure you do, having been in the region, is that the former Kurdistan, the former homeland of the Kurds, about half of it's in Turkey and half of it's in Iraq, and not even half, maybe a third of it is in Turkey, a third of it in Iraq, and a third of it in Syria. It kind of overlays that intersection up there. Correct me if I'm wrong on my geography. And the Turks don't like them because the Kurds want to be independent. The Syrians hate them because the Kurds want to be independent. And the Iraqis hated them because the Kurds want to be independent.
And it seems like every time we armed someone, we did the same thing in Panama because I was in that war.
Yeah. Yeah.
And where'd they get their arms? U.S.
Yeah. Well, I'm convinced that
Noriega in there.
Yeah. I'm convinced that the reason why George Herbert Walker Bush took out Noriega was because Noriega knew where the bodies were buried. He, you know, Noriega was probably part of the whole Iran-Contra, you know, drug deal thing. And had, you know, he was a very, very, very dirty guy, but he was dirty with the complicity of the U.S. government. George Herbert Walker Bush had been the head of the CIA. Noriega had been working with the CIA. And what did they do with Noriega? They brought him to the United States and they put him in lockdown. They have, to this day, they have not allowed Noriega to talk to a reporter. I don't think that that's a coincidence.
No, it's not at all. It's all tied in together, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And like I say, very few times in history have we armed someone and it works out the way we wanted it to.
Yeah.
In World War II, it worked out with England and France. It did not work out with the Russians.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that you could say that. The Russians, in fact, I think played a larger role in defeating Hitler than we did. I mean, they certainly lost more people. They lost 20 million people in that war. But I get your point. There have not been a lot of time. Thank you, Joe, for the call. There was a famous psychologist, Abraham Maslow, made the comment that if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. We've got to stop thinking that the only tool we have is our military. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Jim in Andersonville, Tennessee. Hey, Jim. What's up?
Hello.
Hey.
I just wanted to say that I am one of the people that took you up on your get out there and get active, and I'm involved in the local Democratic Party and supporting a candidate named Mary Hedrick, who basically the Democratic Party is totally ignoring because we're here in East Tennessee, and I guess they have given up on us.
Hmm. So how can people find out about this, Jim?
MaryHedrick.com.
H-E-D-R-I-C-K?
That is correct.
MaryHedrick.com.
She's a medical doctor and she's a very intelligent woman. She's also a computer scientist. She's running against a guy named Chuck Fleischman, who's one of your bought and sold Republicans, who's basically pro-life and, you know.
He's the incumbent?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
He's been in office for two terms now, and we're trying desperately to get him out.
Well, good luck, Jim. And Mary, MaryHedrick.com. People can check it out. Jim, thanks for the call, and thanks for stepping up. This is what we all need to be doing, is infiltrating and taking over the Democratic Party from within. Thank you very much. Wynn in Emporia, Virginia. Hey, Wynn, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I'd like to make a couple interrelated points. You mentioned earlier that we haven't been able to get a Surgeon General because the Republicans filibustered President Obama's appointment.
Yes, Dr. Murthy.
If my memory is correct, I think it was because the doctor he appointed was in favor of asking physicians to ask their patients if there was a gun in the home.
Yeah.
And, of course,
it wasn't even that specific. He simply said that gun violence is a public health issue, if my recollection is correct.
Okay. Well,
these things flow from that.
I'm a retired physician, and everybody's hair has been on fire over the last few weeks about one case of Ebola where a patient died and he contracted it in Africa, and one case of Ebola that was the patient that the nurse contracted from the patient. How many people have died of gun violence in the last few weeks because we don't have this Surgeon General?
It's probably been dozens.
I'm sure. I mean, that's sort of a rhetorical question.
Right.
But, you know, we can't talk about gun violence. We've had, you know, a handful of cases, most of them brought to this country with Ebola. People are dying every day from gun violence, and we couldn't get in a Surgeon General. We thought it was important to talk about it.
Yeah. Wynn has vanished.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, there you are. No, you're absolutely right. And the NRA led that filibuster, and the NRA bought and sold the Republican senators who did it. You're absolutely right. Wynn, thanks for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick, you wanted to talk about Franklin Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights?
That and a couple other points. Yes, you'd be surprised. A number of people are seemingly supposed to be intelligent college graduates that have never even heard of Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights, the Economic Bill of Rights.
Right.
And it's my humble opinion that Roosevelt was probably one of the greatest presidents and visionaries this country has ever had.
I agree.
And second point, I think all your loyal listeners, me included, ought to draft you to run for political office. You, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders. This country's got to go in another direction. Otherwise, if we don't get the carbon caps on, I live here in West Virginia. They're fracking like crazy. They're going to put 300 new wells in Lewis County. Oh, it's going to bring 400 jobs to Lewis County, but at what cost? I mean, they're tearing up the roads. Dominion tells the local government what to do. And people need jobs, and that's like this, the political ads right now here in West Virginia. It's all about coal and jobs. Well, when all the steel mills closed down and all the steel started being imported and I was in the trade, nobody raised that much stink.
Yeah.
You know, and
that's because everybody said, both Democrats and Republicans said, oh, free trade is going to solve all problems. Yes, you're going to lose some jobs here, but you'll make up more jobs there. And they, you know, that everything will be wonderful. And it turns out, I think, you know, people were well-intentioned. I think they actually believed that stuff, or at least some of them. But the proof is there.
Excuse me. I pointed out to somebody that's in the coal industry. I said, well, what about your grandchildren? If this planet can't support life, you will have no grandchildren.
Right.
You know, I think I read somewhere that within 30 years, if we don't get our emissions down to a certain level, it's going to be irreversible.
That's correct. That's the best estimate.
That's a frightening thought.
Yeah, that is really, really, really serious stuff. Thank you very much for the call, Rick, and thanks for pointing that out. And yes, FDR's Second Bill of Rights, I need to do an entire program on it soon. Adam in Chicago. Hey, Adam. You don't think this election is going to matter?
In a nutshell.
How so?
I don't think anything significant will come of the election, no matter which way it goes, I would say.
Oh, I think it'll be huge. If the Republicans take the Senate, there is no chance. If Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies or retires, or if Anthony Kennedy dies or retires, and they're the two most likely, but who knows? You've got, I think, five justices now who are over 70 years old. If any of them leave the court in the next 2 years and you've got a Republican Senate, you are not going to get anybody as progressive as Elena Kagan or Sonia Sotomayor through the Senate for confirmation. You're going to end up with some, you know, milquetoast, you know, half Democrat, half Republican, you know, who knows what's going to happen kind of person. It'll be what's his name, who retired back to New Hampshire. Justice Souter. You know, and that, I mean, that would be a disaster. Not to mention all the other things that are disasters, but because the most powerful branch of government has become the judiciary, even though it's not what the founders envisioned, it's not what the Constitution lays out, and the most powerful part of the judiciary is the Supreme Court, and the Constitution explicitly says that they're not supposed to be the most powerful. Article 3, Section 2 says they have to operate within the constraints, within the regulations defined by Congress, and within the exceptions defined by Congress. But, hey, tell that to Scalia, right? The Supreme Court hangs in the balance. This election is a BFD. It's a big deal. Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today and you know, keeping the flame alive, right? Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport, and it's not enough to just vote. You've got to show up. You've got to participate. Share the word. Spread the word. Tell your friends. Tag your hit. We'll see you tomorrow. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.